So I would like to give a talk. Everybody here okay? Speaker's working okay for everyone? Mm-hmm. I would like to give a talk on... I'd like to give a participatory talk in that you're supposed to participate. So in telling you that, listen in a way that... You're going to know you're going to participate, all of you, at some point. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a myth. It's a Buddhist myth. And there's many versions of this myth. Some are quite elaborate. Some are somewhat modest. It has to do with the story of the Buddha's life. We don't really know that much about him. It's very hard to tease apart facts from fiction, fact from myth. But in calling it a myth, you know, myths have functions in human lives as stories that are very different than maybe what that the fact has, that true stories have. That they're often metaphorical, or they point to something, some aspect of the human life or human psyche that, you know, points to something that some people will say is true, even though the story itself might not be true. It's pointing to some piece of wisdom or understanding that is very useful or helpful. And one of the ways to work with myth is to have your own interpretation of a myth, to look and see what is it about this myth that I can relate to. How can I make this myth my own? Or how can I interpret it in a way that is meaningful for me in my life? Rather than reacting to the myth and saying, well, that has nothing to do with me. It only has something to do with you if you choose to make it that way. And so you can stay kind of passive and distant and say, I don't want to touch that. Or you can say, well, that's interesting, it's in the myth, and well, if I look at my life through that filter, through that understanding, this is what I understand, and that's useful to see that. So I'm going to offer you a myth. And so the way it's participatory is that you have to engage in this myth. I'm hoping you'll engage with it and somehow find meaning in it for yourself. It's actually, the myth has to do with how the Buddha came to engage in a spiritual quest. How he kind of was motivated to start a spiritual life, his Buddhist practice, his quest for liberation. And there are two parts to this story. The first part had to do with when he was 6 years old. And it's a story that I've often told, but I only usually tell one version of the myth, and I want to tell a different version of the myth this evening. The story, as it's told, in the more elaborate versions of the Buddha's life, is the Buddha was the son of a king. And part of how a king asserts his sovereignty in this myth is to preside over the spring plowing festival, kind of ritual plowing of the first plowing of the spring. Somehow that's supposed to assert his authority and place among the population. And the Buddha, being 6 years old, was kind of left on the edge of the field in the shade of a rose apple tree, kind of forgotten temporarily, while the king and the entourage and people were out there plowing the field. And the usual way I've told the story, the way I've learned the story, is that in being forgotten there on the edge of the field, the Buddha sat peacefully under the tree, and as sometimes a young child might do, can do at times, settled into a very deep state of meditation, into what's called the first jhana, the first absorption, that was characterized as having a lot of joy, a lot of strong sense of well-being. And that sometimes in a child who doesn't have much, maybe, self-consciousness or preoccupations or worries, a lot of kind of the superficiality of the mind can fall away pretty easily, and sometimes can fall into some state of deep well-being, meditative well-being, without even knowing that's what it is. And that experience became a reference point for the Buddha much later, that experience of well-being. And he took that experience of well-being as a suggestion of how a person can continue in doing meditative practice when he had done everything else available at India at that time. And so that sense of well-being was a doorway to a spiritual life. The version of the story I want to tell you here is that in looking at the spring plowing festival, What he saw was he saw the oxen, the ox, straining under the weight of the plow. And he saw some of the farmhands helping with the plowing, sweating and working really hard in the heat, kind of sweating, dripping in sweat, straining also with kind of whatever they do, directing the plow or taking care of the ox. And he saw that as the plow was turning over the soil, that it was slicing through all kinds of worms and insects and killing them. And he saw all this suffering in that event. It was supposed to be a happy event, this gala event of celebrating the spring festival. And he saw that the king, in asserting his sovereignty in this ritual way, was causing all this suffering, all this death in these insects and animals and soil. And he became discouraged in the path that was given to him as because he was a son of a king, that he was also meant to be a king. He said, oh, if that's what kingship or rulership brings, I don't want any part of it. And look, this is supposed to be a pleasant event out there. And look all the suffering that people are undergoing. And in that contemplation, in thinking about that, he got so absorbed in that contemplation that he entered into this first jhana. And there's this juxtaposition between the recognizing something that was conventionally seen as being a pleasant, happy event, the celebration, and all the straining and hardness, the suffering that was part of that event. And there's a juxtaposition of him recognizing that suffering and having a sense of well-being in himself. So that's kind of a little bit the complexity of this myth. Then we go forward to a time when the Buddha was 29 years old. And there was a prophecy, jumping around a little bit, there was a prophecy early in the Buddha's life that he would become either a great monarch or he would become a great spiritual teacher, a renunciate. And his father wanted the Buddha to follow in the family business. And so the father then tried to protect his son from encountering the world. Because if he encountered the world, maybe then he would want to kind of go off and do something else besides being a king. So he raised the Buddha in a very protected environment, where the Buddha would never see someone who was old, never see someone who was sick, and never see someone who was dying. So maybe it's pretty hard to do, I imagine. But so the son, the father had built these three palaces for the three seasons of the year, and the Buddha, growing up, was moved around these different palaces in these very ideal environments and very protected environment, being raised to be a king. One day, when he was, it said, when he was 29 years old, he left the suburbs and went out to a pleasure ride with his chariot and his charioteer and went into a pleasure park that was somehow in the area. So here we have this kind of pleasant excursion that's supposed to happen. And while he's in this park, this pleasure park going about, he sees an old man, an old person. And he's never seen an old person before. And he asks, who's that person over there? It's all bent over, walking with a cane, with long white hair, and teethless. And there wasn't plastic surgery and things that they have in Palo Alto now, back then. And in some ways, this kind of story is kind of like someone who maybe grew up in certain suburbs. They can live very isolated from the conditions of life. And his charioteer said, oh, that's an old person. And it's the destiny of all people who follow the course of things without dying early, that sooner or later, everyone, you also, will become an old person like that. And he's shocked to hear that. He continues on his journey, and he sees a sick person. I don't remember how sick, but probably pretty sick. And he said, who's that? Well, that's a sick person. Sooner or later, everyone gets sick, says the charioteer. And the Buddha is shocked by this, that this is the condition of human life. He didn't know that. And then he goes along further, and he sees a dead person. And he's never seen a dead person before. I grew up in the suburbs, And I didn't see a dead person, a corpse, until I went as an 11-year-old to Nepal. And our culture, where I grew up in, kind of, I was very isolated and protected from those kinds of things, you know. But there, I remember seeing some people carrying a dead child on a stretcher down to the river to have the cremation. So if, you know, here he was 29, and for the first time he encountered death. And he, same thing, what's that? He doesn't know. And the charioteer says, that's a dead person. Sooner or later, everyone, including you, will become a person like that. You'll be dead. So he's shocked by this. What's this? And this moves him very deeply. Then he continues on his way, and then he sees a fourth sign. So sometimes called the four signs. The fourth sign, and this is, he sees a renunciant, someone who's dedicated himself to the spiritual or the contemplative life, the spiritual life. And this person appears very serene, very peaceful, has a kind of happy glow and radiance about him. And the Buddha has never seen such a person before. So not only in the palace has he been isolated from sickness, old age, and death, but he's been isolated from the kind of spiritual peace or well-being that someone who practices can encounter, can develop, cultivate. And he sees this for the first time. And he says, what's that? Who's that? And the charioteer explains, and this is a renunciate, this is a contemplative, someone who's dedicated himself to the spiritual life. And the Buddha is very inspired by this sight and says, oh, maybe there's another way to live than living life in the palace. And he decides that he's going to confront and deal with the issues of suffering that's represented by sickness, old age, and death. And he decides he also is going to become a renunciant and find a reliable happiness, a reliable peace that somehow is a balance or is a counter to the sufferings of life that we encounter. So that inspired him then, and he left the palace and then started a spiritual journey. In this story also, then, you have a juxtaposition. Various kinds. You have the juxtaposition of the Buddha going off into what was supposed to be a pleasant excursion into the pleasure parks, and then seeing sickness, old age, and death, and finding out that things are not as they seem, finding out that he had been protected from seeing some of the fundamental existential conditions of what it's like to be a human being. But in seeing that, he was motivated. And then when he saw the renunciant and saw the happiness of the renunciant, he was that motivation had a channel to do something, to go in a certain direction for himself, to engage in a spiritual life. So that this is a very important part of the mythological part of Buddhist tradition, is this example of the Buddha encountering the four signs and then being motivated to engage in a spiritual life. There are plenty of people, I think, who have encountered some degree of sickness, old age, or death, or some encounter like that, who, rather than being crushed by that, or discouraged by that, or run away from that, have really seen that in a very direct way and say, oh, this will motivate me. This is motivating me. I think I'm going to try to clarify the nature of human life. I'm going to try to get to the root, to the heart of suffering, human suffering. I'm going to engage in a path to liberation and freedom. Or I'm going to find some way of expressing my compassion and concern for the world that I see out there. So that's the myth. And now it's your turn to make it your own. Is there some way in your life that you have been protected or been isolated or been ignorant or been in denial about some aspect of your life or the human condition, and at some point in your life you woke up to that? It came into your life, you saw it, this is, oh, I didn't see it before, now I see it. What was pleasant is not so pleasant after all. What is so promising doesn't really offer what I thought it had to offer. Oh, there's something going on here that I didn't realize about suffering or love or peace, or, you know, so it can be a wide range of things. something you didn't know that you were protected from or ignorant of, that at some point you woke up to or became clear of, it came into your life very strongly. And in coming into your life, did it motivate you? Did it change you? Or could it change you? Can you imagine now thinking about it? Can you allow it to change you? And how would it change you? How has it changed you? Is that myth of the Buddha something that speaks to you in your own experience of life? And can you identify something in your life that's been like that? Is that question clear enough? Is that clear enough? Yeah? Only people who I see is nodding yes. So people who... I should ask it differently. Is it not clear enough? Okay. So what I'd like to ask you to do is for you to form little groups of four and have it and go around the group and each of you should maybe take about a minute or two perhaps a little, and just kind of talk about what came up for you about this myth and how you can personalize it, how you can make it your own, how you can use it to interpret your own life. And go around, you have a conversation for a while together, each one talking, and after you've gone around, all four of you, you can talk about it whatever way you want further. And then after a few minutes, I'll ring a bell, and then I'll give you another question for your group to look at around this topic. Now, some of you, this is the last thing you want to do is to come to a meditation group and be quiet and meditate and then have to talk to someone. And I can appreciate that. Some of you are shy or something. And it's pretty common for people to when they hear this point, that we're doing this, want to bolt. I'm out of here. And you're welcome to do that. It's okay. But it's also very common for people to come and tell me afterwards they didn't really want to stay, they weren't looking forward to it, but they're really glad they did. That it really, you know, it was really helpful for them, very important to do it. If you don't want to do it and you want to stay, you're welcome to just stay where you are and be quiet. You can meditate. You can just be quiet, not participate. Just form a little group. And then just stay. And then afterwards, when we form, we'll have some discussion. And you can kind of listen to what that is like. So whatever you want to do is fine. But I really want to encourage you. It's really helpful, I think, these discussions. So if you're willing, could you form little groups of four? And then have a little conversation. Each of you talk about for a minute or two. Monitor yourself. And then after a while, I'll give you more instruction. So I'm going to give some other instructions now. And I don't know if all the groups finished your conversation. Did you feel finished, or some people didn't go? You know, if you didn't go around, you can continue with going around and forgetting about the next question, if you want. But the next question is for you to discuss together and have some conversation around as an individual, but how as a member of a society, or how a society or a community of people might also stay ignorant or stay of something really important that's going on in the wider society, or, you know, what are the ways in which societies do this, communities do this? Stay unaware, ignorant, in denial, protected from encountering what's really going on. So you can thank your group and then just reform as a big group here. So part of the teaching around the four signs, seeing sickness, old age and death, and then the renunciant, is that seeing those things well can be a source of motivation. And motivation is one of the precious resources, precious treasures of who we are. And so just that to use our encounter with sickness, old age, and death, or what those represents, as a source of motivation. I know that one of the issues for a lot of people who live in urban life, lay life, working, having maybe have to take care of family and many things, is sometimes having the energy or the, finding the time or the energy or the motivation to engage in their spiritual life and their meditative life and path to liberation. And when people are tired and exhausted and doing a lot of things, it can be hard to have the energy to be motivated to sit down to meditate in the evening or in the morning or at different times, or and engage in the many different ways that people are engaged in a spiritual life. But it's said that a real needing, really allowing yourself to see the nature of the human condition in some deep way, not being protected from it or isolated from it or avoiding it, is one of the ways to arouse the motivation to overcome the limitations that maybe come with our lives, so that we can find the energy to engage in practice. Does anyone want to have any comments? Anyone want to make any comments about what came up for you, or what it was like to have the discussion? Any understandings or realizations that came in being part of the conversation?
Thank you. Oh my gosh, this is my first time here, and I don't. I guess this is just funny, you know. I'd listened to a great deal of the audio Dharma. I was so excited about coming to hear Gil talk. And then to get this little like, oh, wait, we need to talk to the other people. Oh. But I just wanted to say thank you, because I just, you know, I learned so much from everyone in my little group. It was just amazing. And I got so much, I don't know, more from that than...
And listening to audio Dharma.
Yeah. Precisely. So thank you. I know this wasn't so much about what we talked about in the group, but this little
great
session anyway.
Thank you. It's very nice. I appreciate that a lot, because I think that sometimes people focus a little bit too much on teachers, and we can learn a lot from each other and from our own experience, and so perhaps that would happen to you. Thank you.
It was nice to talk in our group, and this isn't exactly what we talked about, but I always think about society as having integrity, like, you know, like water has a surface tension, and there's kind of this, you know, we have this like need to fit in with everyone else, and sometimes it seems like if everyone's kind of doing the same thing, it can be a good thing, you know, it keeps you from going crazy and, you know, going off the deep edge, but sometimes it's, you know, it's kind of holds us in doing the same thing more than is healthy. And I always remember, I think it was maybe even Herb Cain who said in one of his columns, never underestimate the power of one person who, you know, believes in what he's doing and he's doing the right thing. And I think he was talking about Gandhi, actually. And that was very inspiring. Here's this totally conventional columnist, you know, making space to talk about Gandhi. And that was... for the peace cranes, the thousand cranes, after the atomic bombs.
Mm. Thank you. I had doubts whether I could get you to stop talking when ring the bell. And now... anybody else want to offer anything?
I'm not as new as you. But not that old either. But I just want to affirm what this means to have a place like this. My husband and I were driving for 20, 25 minutes to get here, and we thought, this is kind of a solid, some wonderful word, that it's a solid center in our lives, just to weekly, and we don't participate that much, but just the solid center of people, some we know, but you feel like we know who you are. You wouldn't be coming here unless something was going on inside. So there's a real awareness and just a affirmation that somehow we're supposed to be really learning, and you may not know what it is always at whatever age you are. But this is such an affirming thing for me personally, and I think it is for everyone.
Okay, thank you.
That it exists.
And I think it's very important for periodically have a chance to meet other people in the community. Often when we come here, you know, there's sometimes very little chance to do that. People who don't come when we do one of these rare events like this, They can come for many weeks and kind of not even meet anybody because it's so easy. It's a meditative group to come and go. So this kind of helps the community come together more also. So I hope you're all well motivated. Don't stay up meditating too late tonight. Thank you.